Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Abandon by Blake Crouch, performed by Luke Daniels. This book is dedicated to Aiden Crouch. In the West, the past is very close. In many places, it still believes it's the present. John Masters. Thursday, December 28th, 1893. Wind rips through the crags 1,000 feet above, nothing moving in this godforsaken town, and the mule Skinner knows that something is wrong. 2 miles south stands Bartholomew Packer's mine, the Godsend, a 20-stamp mill that should be filling this box canyon with the thudding racket of the rock crushers pulverizing ore. The sound of the stamps in operation is the sound of money being made, and only 2 things will stop them: Christmas and tragedy. He dismounts his albino steed, the horse's pinked nostrils flaring, dirty mane matted with ice. The single rig saddle is snow-crusted as well, its leather and cloth components, the mochila and shabrack, frozen stiff. He rubs George's neck, speaking in soft, low tones he knows will calm the animal, telling him he did a good day's work and that a warm stable awaits with feed and fresh water. The mule Skinner opens his wallet, collects the pint of busthead he bought at a bodega in Silverton, and swallows the remaining mouthful, whiskey crashing into his empty stomach like iced fire. He wades through waist-deep snow to the mercantile, bangs his shopmaids on the doorframe. Inside, the lamps have been extinguished and the big stove squats dormant in the corner, unattended by the usual constellation of miners jawboning over coffee and tobacco. He calls for the owner as he crosses the board floor, moving between shelves, past stacked crates and burlap sacks bulging with sugar and flour.
"Jessup, it's Brady. Are you in back?"
The 12 burros crane their scrawny necks in his direction when Brady emerges from the murk. He reaches into his greatcoat, pulls out a tin of Star Navy tobacco, and shoves a chaw between lips and gums gone blackish purple in the last year.
"What the hell?"
he whispers. When he delivered supplies 2 weeks ago, this little mining town was bustling. Now Abandon looms listless before him in the gloom of late afternoon, streets empty, snow banked high against the unshoveled plank sidewalks, no tracks as far as he can see. The cabins scattered across the lower slopes lie buried to their chimneys, and with not a one of them smoking, the air smells too clean. Brady is a man at home in solitude, often spending days on the trail alone in wild, quiet places, but this silence is all wrong, a lie. He feels menaced by it, and with each passing moment more certain that something has happened here. A wall of dark clouds scrapes over the peaks, and snowflakes begin to speck the sleeves of his slicker. Here comes the wind. Chimes clang together over the doorway of the murk. It will be night soon. He makes his way up the street into the saloon, still half expecting Joss Maddox, the beautiful barkeep, to assault him with some gloriously profane greeting. No one's there. Not the mute piano player, not a single customer. And again, no light from the kerosene lamps, no warmth from the pot-bellied stove, just a half-filled glass on the pine bar, the beer frozen through. The path to the nearest cabin lies beneath untrodden snow, and without webs, it takes 5 minutes to cover 100 yards. He pounds his gloved fist against the door, counts to 60. The latch string hasn't been pulled in, and despite the circumstance, he feels like a trespasser as he steps inside, uninvited. In the dark, his eyes strain to adjust. Around the base of a potted spruce tree, crumpled pages of newspaper clutter the dirt floor, remnants of Christmas. Food languishes untouched on a rustic table, far too lavish to be any ordinary meal for the occupants of this cramped one-room cabin. This was Christmas dinner. He removes a glove, touches the ham, cold and hard as ore. A pot sits there, the beans frozen in their broth. The cake feels more like pumice than sponge, and 2 jagged glass stems still stand upright, the wine having frozen and shattered the crystal cups. Outside again, back with his pack train, he shouts, turning slowly in the middle of the street so the words carry in all directions.
"Anyone here?"
His voice and the fading echo of it sound so small rising against the vast, indifferent sweep of wilderness. The sky dims. Snow falls harder. The church at the north end of town disappears in the storm. It's 27 miles back to Silverton, and the pack train has been on the trail since before first light. The burros need rest. Having driven mules the last 16 hours, he needs it too, though the prospect of spending the night in abandon, in this awful silence, unnerves him. As he slips a boot into the stirrup, ready to take the burros down to the stables, he notices something beyond the cribs at the south end of town. He urges George forward, trots through deep powder between the false-fronted buildings, and when he sees what caught his eye, he whispers,
"You old fool."
Just a snowman scowling at him, spindly arms made of spruce branches, pine cones for teeth and eyes, garland for a crown. He tugs the reins, turning George back toward town, and the jolt of seeing her provokes,
"Lord God Almighty!"
He drops his head, tries to allay the thumping of his heart in the thin air. When he looks up again, the young girl is still there, perhaps 6 or 7, apparition pale and just 10 feet away, with locomotive black curls and coal eyes to match. So dark and with such scant delineation between iris and pupil, they more resemble wet stones.
"You put a fright in me," he says. "What are you doing out here all alone?"
She backpedals.
"No, don't be scared. I ain't the boogeyman."
Brady alights, wades toward her through the snow. With the young girl in webs sunk only a foot in powder and the mule skinner to his waist, he thinks it odd to stand eye to eye with the child.
"You all right?"
he asks.
"I didn't think there was nobody here."
The snowflakes stand out like white confetti in the child's hair.
"They're all gone,"
she says. No emotion, no tears, just an unaffected statement of fact.
"Even your ma and pa?"
She nods.
"Where'd they all go to? Can you show me?"
She takes another step back, reaches into her gray woolen cloak. The single-action army revolver is a heavy sidearm, and it sags comically in the child's hand, so she holds it like a rifle. Brady is too surprised to do a thing but watch as she struggles with the hammer.
"Okay, I'll show you,"
she says, the hammer locked back, sighting him up, her small finger already in the trigger guard.
"Now hold on, wait just a—"
"Stay still."
"That ain't no toy to point in someone's direction. It's for—"
"Killing. I know. You'll feel better directly."
As Brady scrambles for a way to rib up this young girl to hand him the gun, he hears its report ricocheting through the canyon, finds himself lying on his back, surrounded by a wall of snow. In the oval of gray winter sky, the child's face appears, looking down at him.
"What in God's—"
"It made a hole in your neck."
He attempts to tell her to stable George and the burros, see that they're fed and watered. After all the work they put in today, they deserve at least that. Only gurgles emerge, and when he tries to breathe, his throat whistles. She points the revolver at his face again, one eye closed, the barrel slightly quivering, a parody of aiming. He stares up into the deluge of snowflakes, the sky already immersed in a bluish dusk that seems to deepen before his eyes, and he wonders,
"Is the day really fading that fast, or am I?"
2009. 1. Abigail Foster stared through the windshield at the expired parking meter. Her fingers strangled the steering wheel, knuckles blanching, hands beginning to cramp. This had all seemed like such a good idea a month ago back in New York when she'd pitched the article to Margot, her editor at Great Outdoors. Now, on the verge of seeing him for the first time in 26 years, she realized she'd done herself the disservice of glossing over this moment and the fact that she'd have to walk into that building and face him. Her watch showed 7:05, which meant it was 5:05 Mountain Time. She'd sat in this parking space for 20 minutes, and he was probably about to leave, thinking she decided not to come. The hostess showed her toward the back of the brew pub, which at 5 PM stood mostly empty. Peanut shells littered the floor, crunching beneath the heels of her black pumps, and the reek of brewing beer infused the air with a yeasty sourness. The hostess held the back door open and motioned to the only occupied table on the patio. Abigail stepped outside, smoothed the Cavalli skirt she paid way too much for last year in Milan. The doubt resurfaced. She shouldn't have come. No story was worth this. He sat alone with his back to her at a west-facing table, with the town of Durango, Colorado spread out before him in its high valley, specked with the icy yellows of cottonwood and aspen, enclosed by pine-wooded hills and bare shale hills, and farther back, the spruce forests and jagged peaks of the San Juans. The sound of the patio door banging shut caught his attention. He looked over his shoulder, and at the sight of her slid his chair back from the table and stood. Tall, sturdy, wavy silver hair, dark blues, and dressed like something out of Backpacker magazine. Plaid Patagonia button-up shirt tucked into a comfortable pair of jeans. Livestrong bracelet, Teva sandals. She felt that knot constricting in her stomach again, noticed his left hand trembling. He seized the chair he'd been sitting in to steady it. Hi, Lawrence. She knew he was 52, but he'd aged even better than his photo on the history department's website indicated. No handshake, no hug, just 5 seconds of what Abigail ranked as the most excruciating eye contact she'd ever held. Easing down into a chair, she counted 3 empty pints on the table, wished she'd had the benefit of alcohol to steel herself for this meeting. She rifled through her purse, found her sunglasses. It was Halloween, and though the air carried a chill, at this elevation the intensity of direct sunlight made it pleasant to sit outdoors.
"I'm glad you came," Lawrence said.
A waiter costumed as a hula dancer approached the table.
"Want a beer, Abigail?"
"Sure."
"They have a bunch of different..."
"I don't care. Something light."
He said to the waiter,
"Bring her a rock-hopped pail."
"Right on."
The whistle of a steam-powered locomotive blew somewhere up in the valley. Abigail saw the plume of smoke in the distance, heard the chugging palpitations of the valve gears as the train steamed south through the heart of town.
"I don't have any backpacking gear," she said.
"Scott will outfit you."
"Who's Scott?"
"Our guide."
The silence, uncomfortable as it came, crawled under her skin.
"Pretty town you have here."
She couldn't help thinking this didn't feel anything like she'd imagined it would. Having run countless versions of this moment through her head, they'd all carried more gravitas. She would scream at him. She'd hit him. They'd break down and cry together. He'd apologize. She'd accept. She wouldn't. Now she understood none of that would happen. They were just 2 people sharing a table, trying to limp through the awkwardness.
"I'm curious," she said. "All this time, and now you contact me."
"I've followed your journalism career, subscribed to all the magazines you regularly contribute to, and I thought this expedition might be good fodder for your..."
"But you haven't been interested in helping me since I was 4 years old.
Lawrence slugged back the rest of his dark beer, stared at the mountains, wiped the foam from his beard. Abigail said,
"That came out more angry than..."
"No, it's fine. You've got standing to be as angry as you want."
"I'm not, though."
The patio door opened and the waiter returned with Abigail's pint and another round for Lawrence. When he'd left, she raised her glass.
"Lawrence," she said, "here's to our past. Fuck it."
He grinned.
"That easy, huh?"
"We can pretend."
They clinked pints and Abigail sipped her golden beer.
"So, why'd you come?"
Lawrence asked.
"To be honest, I never expected a response to that email."
"Funny. I was just sitting out in the car, building the nerve to walk in here and trying to answer that question for myself."
The sun ducked behind the mountains and Abigail shivered, the rocky slopes and snowfields blushing with alpenglow. 2. At 4:30 the next morning, Abigail hurried across the parking lot of the Doubletree, moving toward a big Suburban where 4 figures stood in the diseased light of a flickering street lamp. The air was perfumed with wet sage and resonant of the jabbering Animas River, which flowed behind the hotel. They all turned at the sound of her footsteps, her eyes gravitating first to her father, then to the man standing beside him, who came only to his shoulders. His head was smooth-shaven and his beard, just beginning to fade in, matched the gray of his deep and thoughtful eyes, Emmett Tozer, he said as they shook hands. Guess you could say we're responsible for this outing. Lawrence was nice enough to agree to take us out, share his expertise.
Abigail Foster, freelance journalist.
She turned to the woman holding Emmett's arm.
June Tozer?
June's face lighted up and she took Abigail's hand in both hers.
Pleasure to meet you, Abigail.
She stood just over 5 feet with a streak of white running down the middle of her chin-length brown hair. A sweet energy seemed to exude through June's fingers. It made Abigail's arm tingle, as if a gentle current were passing through. And I'm Scott Sawyer. I own Hinterlands Incorporated. I'll be your guide for this trip. Abigail shook the calloused hand of the beautiful man in a fish t-shirt and torn khakis, instantly liking what she saw, a feeling she sensed he reciprocated. He was young, his hair bleached, probably just shy of 30, and she discerned beneath his faded clothes the body of a seasoned outdoorsman. They rode up toward the mountains in the dark, and Abigail was dreaming again before they left the city limits of Durango. She slept soundly, and when she woke, the Suburban was ascending a steep, rocky road. Scott and Lawrence talked in the front seat, but their conversation seemed muffled. She swallowed. Her ears popped. The sounds of the straining engine and tires crunching over rocks came rushing in. Abigail sat up, rubbed her eyes. The dashboard clock read 6:01 a.m. The sky had lightened into dawn and they were climbing through a canyon, the one-lane road following the path of a stream. Scott finally pulled over onto the edge of a meadow and parked beside a dinged and rusted Bronco that had long ago ceased to be one discernible color. But despite its state of disrepair, it had somehow managed to drag a trailer up the road. Abigail climbed outside after Emmett and June, heard the chatter of a stream. They huddled between the vehicles, their breath steaming, the air redolent of spruce. The driver's door of the Bronco squeaked open, and a man stepped down into the frosted grass. He was tall, his beard thick save for a few bare spots, his walnut hair drawn back into a ponytail. Scott said, "Meet Jared Spicer, my trustworthy assistant. He's an excellent outdoorsman, so you should know you're all in capable hands." Jared let slip a yawn, said,
"Sorry. Still waiting for the coffee to kick in."
He walked to the back of the trailer, unlocked the doors.
"Gunter, Gerald, time to go to work."
Abigail smiled when two llamas stepped down into the meadow and began munching on the grass. She approached them, reached out to pet the black one, but it pulled away, affronted by the familiarity. "I'd rethink that, Abigail," Scott said. "Gunter spits." He opened the back hatch of the Bronco. "Now, if you'll step over here, we can start getting you all fitted for your packs." As Abigail watched Scott cinch down the llama packs, she heard a car coming up the canyon. A moment passed, and then a hunter green Ford Expedition appeared around the bend. It veered off the road and pulled up onto the meadow, a rack of sirens mounted on top, San Juan County Sheriff's Department emblazoned on the driver's and passenger's doors. A woman climbed out and approached the group, which had gathered by the llama trailer. She was petite and pretty, with bright, friendly eyes and long brown hair split into braided pigtails. "Morning," she said, and tipped the brim of her Stetson. A sheriff's star had been embroidered into her black parka. "Y'all about ready to shove off?" "Yep," Scott said, pulling the strap to tighten the hip belt of his pack. The sheriff pointed to Scott, said, "I see you're taking a fly rod. You wouldn't mind letting me have a peek at your fishing license?"
"Not at all."
Scott walked down to the sheriff and pulled his wallet out of his fleece pants. He flipped it open. She nodded. "Y'all look like you're headed in for the long haul." June said,
"Well, we've got a ways to go. How far did you say, Scott?"
17 miles.
"Yeah, a 17-mile hike into this old ghost."
"What's your name, Sheriff?"
Lawrence asked.
"I feel like we've met before."
"Jennifer? And yours?"
"Lawrence Kendall. Get down to Durango much, Jennifer?"
"Not if I can help it."
She cocked her head.
"Where'd you think we met?"
"I don't remember, but you look familiar."
"Don't think we have, and I'm pretty good with faces."
She addressed the group. "Well, I assume you all purchased backcountry insurance."
"They did," Scott said. "I'm the guide. I insisted they buy it."
"Where you taking them?"
"Grizzly Gulch."
I thought she said you were headed to a ghost town. There are no ruins in Grizzly Gulch, at least that I know of. She leveled her gaze on him, unblinking. Abigail watched Scott. His Adam's apple rolled in his throat.
Actually, we're going to abandon, Emmett said.
Without averting her eyes from Scott, the sheriff asked, And what are you planning to do there?
Take some pictures. My wife and I are paranormal photographers. Depending on what we get, we may do a show in San Francisco this winter.
The sheriff said to Scott, No call to lie to me if all you're going to do is take pictures. He nodded.
That is all you're planning on doing.
Of course.
And you've got the permits to visit Abandon?
They do.
The sheriff looked at June and Emmett.
Could I see them, please?
Emmett reached into his jacket and pulled out an envelope, which he handed to the sheriff. She thumbed through the papers.
Wow, a group permit. They don't give out many of these.
Emmett said, We've been trying to score one for 3 years.
The sheriff gave the envelope back but lingered a moment longer, her brown eyes passing over each member of the group as if taking some kind of mental inventory.
I hope you all have a real safe trip, she said, then tipped her hat again and strode back to the expedition.
As they watched her climb in, crank the engine, and continue on up canyon, Abigail caught something, but it was subtle, and she instantly let it go. In a day and a half, she'd remember this moment, wish to God she'd paid it more credence. What she saw was a glance between Scott and Lawrence. Just 2 seconds of eye contact that looked something like relief. 3. They spent the first 2 hours climbing out of the canyon on a trail that switchbacked through a forest of old-growth Engelmann spruce. Abigail found herself near the back, between Emmett and Lawrence, trying to come to terms with the emaciated air. At a break in the trees, she peered down and saw the road they'd taken out of Silverton, just a twisting brown thread 800 feet below. The sound of the stream had faded into a sustained hiss. The next time they stopped to rest, she'd lost the stream altogether, and there was no wind, only the thud of her oxygen-starved heart banging in her ears. At midday, they crossed a stretch of open country, the grasses dry and yellowed, littered with achromatic midsummer blooms of columbine, lupine, and Indian paintbrush. Abigail could see a subgroup of the San Juans, the mountains tan in direct sun, gray in the shadow of clouds, with rags of old snow high on the peaks. The sky shone neon blue. Scott led them to the entrance of a broad valley. They came into a forest of ponderosa, plenty of space between the trees, sunlight pouring onto the pine needle floor of the forest. As they climbed, the occasional spruce appeared among the ponderosa. The pines dwindled. Then they moved through a pure stand of spruce again. Abigail realized they hadn't been following a trail since breakfast. In the early afternoon, they arrived at a small lake, and Scott told everyone to shed their packs. Abigail leaned hers against a rotten stump. Without the weight, she felt like she might float away. She knelt down on the shore and splashed water in her face. The arctic shock of it stole her breath. She sat on the grassy bank and drank from her water bottle. Tall spruce trees rimmed the bank, and the surface of the lake sent back a perfect reflection of the trees and the sky. The water glowed a deep green. She looked through it down to the lake bed, saw a cutthroat motionless among the pastel-colored stones. Jared came over and brought her a bagged lunch, sandwich, apple, Cliff Bar.
How you holding up? He asked.
Feel like I'm breathing through a straw, and my hips hurt from the pack.
I'll adjust the straps again before we leave. You're doing very well.
She shielded her face from the sun and looked up at Jared. She liked his face. She could tell that beneath the beard he was handsome, taller than Scott, even more well-built. But she wondered about the scars, 2 bare patches curving up from the corners of his mouth in the shape of crescent moons. Staring at him, she wished she could see his eyes again. They seemed different. She'd noticed it at the trailhead before the sun came up and drove everyone into sunglasses. They reminded her of something she couldn't quite put her finger on, their density and depth, like they bore some great burden beyond the intake of the present. Jared left to take Emmett and June their lunches. Abigail unwrapped her peanut butter and grape jelly sandwich. She ate, watching the llamas graze the bank. They made camp at 11,000 feet, in a glade just spacious enough to accommodate 5 tents. They were only a few hundred feet below the timberline, and the forest had transitioned into a withered-looking collection of blue spruce and alpine fir, crippled by years of extreme winters. Scott insisted that everyone change out of their wet clothes to avoid hypothermia. Within half an hour, they raised the tents. The guide showed everyone how to inflate the thermarests and arrange their gear inside the vestibules. With still a few hours of light left, Abigail emerged from her tent, bundled in long underwear, fleece pants, a vest, and parka. Emmett and June stood watching Jared construct a campfire ring from a pile of rocks. Lawrence snored in his tent. Scott dug through a giant compression bag filled with what Abigail could only hope was real food, not that granola bar shit. She walked up to him, said,
"I need to use the ladies' room. What do we do about that?"
"I haven't unpacked the toilet yet."
"Really? You have a portable..."
His grin stopped her. "You've never spent a night out in the woods, have you, Abigail?"
"No."
"Well, no worries. There's a bathroom behind every tree." She smiled seductively and raised her middle finger. Abigail found a bit of privacy behind a blue spruce. The air nipped her bare ass. The ground steamed. She glanced at her watch. 6:30 p.m. Still on Manhattan time, and it made her homesick to think of Viv and Jen. Any other Sunday, she'd have just finished working out and showering in a mad rush to meet them for Cosmos at the Zinc Bar. But so far, this trip had been nothing like she'd expected. The thin air, the cold 10 fucking miles, and the hardest still to come. She thought she'd be in her element out here, but she hated everything. The cliff bars, the smelly, bitchy llamas. And there was something about the light beginning to fade and no warm bed to climb into that depressed the hell out of her.
"I'm a city girl," if there was ever a question.
While she squatted there, she gazed back down the valley. That open country they'd crossed several hours ago lay golden in the late afternoon sun, and as she pulled up her pants, she saw it. A few miles below, perhaps at the lake where they'd stopped for lunch, a column of smoke rose out of the forest. As she walked back toward their campsite, she felt glad to have seen it, relieved to know they weren't completely alone out here. 4. Abigail leaned against a fir tree. Down in the gully, Scott worked his way upstream, just past a fork in the channel. She watched him sidearm cast, the bright green line sailing in an S over the rocks, glistening like a spiderweb in the late sunlight, delivering the fly into a small pool. He'd hiked up his fleece pants, and he fished shirtless in a fly vest, knee-deep in the water. Abigail descended quietly to the bank, stood for a while listening to the stream's drowsy prattling.
"Aren't you cold?"
she asked. "Yeah," he said without looking back. "But there's a secret to it."
"What's that?"
"Not caring." He suddenly raised the rod. It dipped. A trout shot out of the pool and splashed into the main current, Scott holding the rod high now, the line taut, the bamboo arcing towards the water. He brought the fish out of the stream, a 12-inch cutthroat, its crimson gill slashes palpitating in the fading light. Scott carefully unhooked the fly, then swung the fish against a rock. It shivered out. He slipped it into a canvas bag. She said,
"Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't you jerk on the rod before it moved?"
"Yeah. I'm impressed you noticed. See, by the time you feel the tap, it's too late. He's already checked it out, realized it's bullshit."
"So how'd you know?"
"Caught him rising to my elk hair caddis. Saw it vanish. Pulled to set the hook."
"No idea what you just said, but it was a lovely thing to watch."
Scott climbed onto the bank, sat down on a carpet of moss. He opened a small box containing an assortment of flies. Abigail, now close enough to read the tattoo that wrapped around his arm above the bicep. Maria, 211-78-515-04, R.I.P. She bent down to the stream, cupped a handful of freezing water, and as she brought it to her mouth, Scott yelled, "No!" She glanced back at him, letting the water run through her fingers.
Notice something about the rocks along the bank below the fork? He asked.
You mean how they're covered with orange algae?
That's not algae. It's a mineral deposit, a visual marker for streams with high metal content, zinc, aluminum, lead.
So this water's toxic?
Yep. That's why I'm fishing upstream from that tributary. It probably runs out of an old mine. He lifted the rod. So, you want to give it a shot? See if you can hook one? 5 minutes later, they stood casting together. Abigail thinking this was like those cheesy scenes in the movies where the guy shows the girl how to work a pool cue. But she didn't care. As their arms moved together, his body against hers, she thought of her recent string of New York men. Beautiful metrosexual train wrecks. Scott didn't strike her as one of those superficial predators she always seemed to be falling for. And for the first time since leaving New York, she didn't want to be home. They sat around a fire, eating trout that had been seasoned with fresh spices and seared on a stone among the embers. There was vegetable soup and a baguette, and over the flames Lawrence roasted whole green chilies stuffed with cheese. He'd also smuggled in a case of Pabst Blue Ribbon. They all agreed one of the best meals they'd ever had. After supper, everyone washed their dishes in the stream until their hands had gone numb in the icy water. By the time they returned to the fire, Jared had stoked the flames into a big blaze. Abigail leaned back in her camp chair, noting the ache in her legs, the blisters on her hips. When she looked up, she saw the cinders rising out of the flames and through the spruce branches toward the night sky. Lawrence pulled a flask from the pocket of his fleece jacket and offered it to June. She unscrewed the cap, took a swig, passed it to her husband. A cloud of smoke gathered around Scott's head, and he asked, "Anyone else want dessert?" The whiskey burned Abigail's throat. She took another sip, sent up a prayer of thanks when the glow settled in, dulling the pain 10 hard miles had inflicted on her body. Lawrence got stoned and slipped into his professorial tone, going on about the history of the ghost town, even reading from the diary of someone who'd lived in Abandon, a woman named Gloria Curtis. But Abigail was too beat, and her mind wandered for the next half hour, only perking up when he told the story of the vanishing, how a man had ridden into Abandon in January of 1894 in search of his missing younger brother, a mule skinner named Brady Sykes, only to find the town empty, not a chimney smoking, the stamp mill silent. "I'm not talking about empty homes where people packed all their belongings and left. This town of 123 souls just up and disappeared on Christmas Day," Emmett asked. "So what happened to the mule skinner's brother?" Lawrence expelled a lungful of smoke. "Did what any of us would have done. Hauled ass out of there. Few days later, he did an interview with the Silverton Standard and Miner. Said the whole ordeal had really spooked him. That the town felt strange, haunted, like the devil had been there. Everyone assumed they'd find the remains of Abandon in the summer when the snow was gone, but they never recovered a single bone."
"That's fucked up," Scott said.
"So what do you think happened, Lawrence?" Emmett asked.
"To the town?"
"Yeah."
The professor sighed, seemed to reflect on the question for a moment, then said confidently,
"I've never shared this with anyone."
Emmett and June imperceptibly leaned forward.
"But I think a big spaceship came down, abducted the whole lot of them."
"Really?"
Lawrence smiled. "Oh, a joke," Emmett said.
"Sorry, but you have to understand, I've been asked what happened to Abandon probably 1,000 times, and I just don't know the answer. There are some Looney Tunes out there who believe the town was taken by aliens or that something supernatural happened."
"What about a virus?" June asked.
"Bad ones were around in the 1890s, but lead poisoning would have been a greater threat to Abandon than an epidemic, what with their drinking water flowing out of the heart of these mountains. But assuming some super virus struck the town, where are the remains? In the absence of any bones, I guess I can see how a person might look to supernatural explanations."
"Even you?" Emmett said.
"In all honesty, I do have a theory, but it's, well, personal. And I haven't shared it with anyone ever, and don't plan to now."
Scott stood, took the water bag hanging from a knob on a tree, and doused the fire. It hissed, bellows of steam lifting into the trees, cold rushing in.
Sorry, folks, but tomorrow comes early. The others said their goodnights and lumbered off to bed. Then just Abigail and Lawrence sat across from each other in the darkness. She got up as soon as she realized it, said,
"Night."
Lawrence stared at the last unyielding coal, scratching his gray beard.
"Sit out here with me a while," he said without looking up.
"I would, really, but I'm cold and tired."
"Abigail?"
"What?"
"I just wanted to..."
"I know, but I can't do this right now, okay? I'm not there yet."
Their campsite glade stood 50 yards through the trees. Abigail had to pee again, but the thought of squatting out here in the dark seemed worse than the pressure in her bladder. She climbed into her one-man tent, her sleeping bag freezing. She crawled inside the down bag and zipped herself up, pulled her long black hair into a ponytail. It reeked of wood smoke. The walk from the campfire to the tent had set her pulse racing, and she listened to the throbbing in her head. When it eased, the hush came. Even on weekends in New York, lying in bed in her studio apartment, the nearest thing to silence contained the noise of sirens and central heating, her refrigerator cutting on and off in the pre-dawn hours. Here, the silence was a vacuum, a total absence. It made her uneasy. With no threat of rain or snow, the guides hadn't stretched the rain flies over the tents. The ceiling of Abigail's was mesh. She reached up, unzipped it. A section of the ceiling fell away and she gasped. Through the opening lay a rectangle of night like none she'd ever seen, powdered with stars that dimmed and brightened, so the entire sky seemed to smolder with the embers of a cosmic fire. She couldn't remember the last time she'd seen stars, had no idea of their profusion. Footsteps swished through the grass nearby, her father stumbling to bed. And as Abigail lay there on the brink of sleep, she puzzled at this life he'd fashioned for himself. He'd certainly aged well, but she wondered if he was happy, what kind of friends he kept, what sort of women he'd been with. Prior to coming to Colorado, she'd finally Googled him, but aside from a brief bio on the Fort Lewis College website, Lawrence's internet presence was light. Exhaustion set in, her sleeping bag warm, her ears detecting the murmur of the stream. 9 meteors flared across her skylight before she succumbed to sleep. And despite all the campfire talk of the vanishing of abandon, there existed no greater mystery for her than the man who snored 20 feet away, alone in his tent. 5. Abigail opened her eyes. A film of ice had formed on her sleeping bag where her breath had misted and frozen during the night. She could hear some of the others stirring in their tents and, farther away, the crackling of what she hoped was a fire. She laced her boots and climbed outside. 8:23 a.m. by her watch, which meant 6:23 here. A heavy frost had blanched the tents and meadow grasses. The llamas grazed nearby. The air tickled her throat going down. She relieved herself behind her favorite blue spruce, then made her way through the trees to the fire. Only Jared was up. He handed her a mug steaming with coffee.
"Take it with anything?"
"Black is bliss."
The coffee tasted strong and rich. She stood close to the flames, watching Jared light another camp stove. His long hair was down. While the water heated, he poured packets of oatmeal into plastic bowls and mixed in dried fruit and chocolate chips.
"Where's Scott?" Abigail asked.
"Helping Emmett. He started throwing up around 3 this morning. Probably altitude sickness. Scott's giving him some more Diamox right now, making sure he stays hydrated. Emmett'll be okay. This kind of thing usually clears up pretty quick."
"Can I help with anything?"
He glanced up at her, their eyes connecting.
"No, I've got it. Thanks, though."
Jared peeled 2 bananas and began to slice them into the oatmeal with a Swiss Army knife. As Abigail watched him prepare their breakfast, she noticed the dog tags dangling from a chain around his neck. Within the hour, they broke camp, Emmett weak but on the mend, the guides having distributed the weight of his pack between them. As they climbed, the firs grew scrawnier, these dwarfed banner trees limbless on the windward side. The forest dwindled into alpine tundra, shrubs, grass, and rock crusted with black and yellow lichen. They proceeded in a tight line, Scott and the llamas leading, Jared bringing up the rear.
Now well above timberline, rock walls ramped up steeply on either side. They climbed a boulder field toward the pass. No grass, only large broken rocks that shifted under their weight, filling the upper regions of the cirque with a strange tinkling. Some had been gouged with potholes, filled with standing water. Black spiders scampered under their boots. Abigail was thinking how these mountains reminded her of Gothic cathedrals, with their towers and chimneys, when somewhere high above, a boulder dislodged, dividing into pieces as it plunged toward them. Scott yelled, "Everybody down! Shield your heads with your packs!" They all crouched as the rocks hurtled toward them, bouncing and breaking and multiplying. Abigail shut her eyes, and she whispered, "Please, please, please." Most of the rocks shattered against a bus-sized boulder just 15 feet away. Silence returned. The air smelled of cordite. Scott called out, "Everybody in one piece?" Abigail looked up, Jared beside her, his eyes still closed, teeth gritted, body quaking. The boulder field steepened near the pass. Abigail used her hands to climb now, the weight of the pack disrupting her balance, feeling envious of the llama's sure-footedness. They came to a series of ledges. "Take your time," Scott yelled. "This section is very sketchy, and the rock's rotten. If you start to freak out, let us know. We'll talk you through it. Focus on what's above you, and don't look in the direction you don't want to go, namely down." The ledges ranged in width from 4 to 6 feet, contouring up the rock face. Abigail focused on putting one foot in front of the other and dragging her left hand along the rock to maintain her balance. The others had gotten ahead of her. At the third switchback, she made the mistake of glancing down, had no idea they'd climbed so high above the boulder field. The exposure overwhelming, waves of dizziness engulfing her, filling her stomach with razor-winged butterflies. Her knees weakened, the world tilted. She stumbled toward the edge. Jared grabbed her arm, pulled her back. She crumpled down on the ledge.
"Abigail? I can't breathe," she gasped.
Jared knelt in front of her.
"You're okay. You're just hyperventilating. Close your eyes and take deep breaths."
She did what he said. Soon the dizziness had passed and she could open her eyes without the world spinning.
"You saved my ass,"
she said as Jared pulled a climbing rope out of his pack.
"What's that for?"
"I'm gonna short rope us together until we reach the top. Can you stand up now?"
Abigail got to her feet and Jared reached around her from behind and began to wrap the rope around her thighs into a makeshift harness.
"Can I ask you something?" she said.
"Sure."
He cinched the rope around her waist.
"How old are you?"
37.
"Were you in Iraq?"
He stopped midway through his knot, turned her around so they faced each other.
"Yeah, actually. How'd you know?"
His voice had tightened. Abigail looked back over the boulder field at the glint of the lake where they'd stopped the previous afternoon.
"Your dog tags," she said.
"Oh, right."
"Other things, too," she thought. "Especially the way you reacted when the rock fell."
A couple years back, she'd written a piece for the Times about soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder, interviewed dozens of vets with PTSD. No question, he had it. She saw the damage in his eyes. At noon, they crested Sawblade Pass, just a wind-ravaged 13,000-foot notch in a cirque of spires, ridden with old snow, sun-cupped and brittle as salt crystals. They dropped their gear, took shelter from the wind. From Abigail's vantage point, she could see down the other side of the pass, a 2,000-foot drop into a box canyon. At the close end, she thought she saw the ruins of a mine. Farther on, perhaps a mile away, rows of dark specks peppered the timberline forest. Emmett yelled,
"Dr. Kendall!"
Lawrence had been exploring a recess in the rock at the end of a nearby ledge. He poked his head out. Emmett waved him over and Lawrence came and squatted beside him.
"What are those specks down there?"
he asked.
"That's abandoned."
Abigail took out her cell phone. It roamed for a moment, got a signal. She called her mother to tell her how beautiful it all was. 6. They spent the next hour descending a talus slope, and by 2 in the afternoon they had reached the remains of the godsend, Bartholomew Packer's mine. The stamp mill looked to be 1 winter away from collapsing. Boards bowed and splayed out on all sides, and amid the wreckage of the mill stood one of its indomitable cast-iron rock crushers. They followed an old wagon trail as clouds filed in from the west. Pockets of snow clung high up the canyon walls, and snow melt bled out from them in streams down the rock face and into the ruts of the trail, making their boots squish in the mud. Ahead lay a grassy lane, lined with rows of weather-beaten structures, all that was left of abandon. Main Street ran for 200 yards down the middle of the canyon, and the party walked 6 abreast between the false-fronted buildings. Many had collapsed. Lawrence pointed to a structure with 6 little balconies.
This was abandoned's red light district. Those were the cribs. Prostitutes would stand on the balconies and try to entice potential customers who were passing by.
How'd this town get its name? June asked.
It was originally named Hope by Bart Packer, but, as a joke, one of the better red miners, who was none too fond of this high, remote canyon, started calling the town Abandon. Name stuck.
What's that? Emmett asked, motioning to a building across the street that had long since collapsed. See that big metal thing in there?
Lawrence walked over and peered into the rubble. This was the assay office. Assayer would evaluate samples for prospectors and the mine, tell you if your ore was high or low grade. That hulk of metal is probably the furnace. Bet if you poked around in there, you'd find some old crucibles, too.
They passed the blacksmith's shop, identifiable only by the anvil sitting amid the rotten boards. Then the dance hall and the general store, where a faded sign had fallen onto the porch. It read, "Especial attention given to the comfort of ladies." Lawrence pointed out the drugstore, meat market, bakery, and harness shop, though they resembled little more than board heaps to Abigail. Midway through Abandon, he stopped them in the street.
Most important place in town.
He gestured to a building whose entire frame slanted to the right.
The saloon, he said, eyes lighting up.
Abigail was thinking how in his element Lawrence was, thrilling people with what had happened in the past. She felt envious of the childlike joy he'd found in his career, wanted a little of that for herself.
I have to tell you about the woman who was tending bar in 1893. Name was Jocelyn Maddox. She was drop-dead gorgeous, sassy, and a black widow. By 25, she'd been married 3 times to rich men, all of whom had died mysteriously. Her last husband's family got wise, proved she'd slowly poisoned him with arsenic. She fled Arizona, ended up, of all places, here. Made a big impression. Men loved her. She was one of the guys, funny, raucous, horribly profane. In November of 1893, someone came prospecting from Arizona, recognized Jocelyn, and reported to Sheriff Curtis that there was a murdering fugitive tending bar in his town. The story checked out, and Ezekiel had no choice but to arrest her. Everything had been arranged to extradite her back to be hanged, but the snows came. It was decided she'd winter in Abandon, be transported to Arizona in the spring. Since half the town was in love with her, instead of just letting Jocelyn rot in jail, they chained her up in the saloon, with a deputy to keep watch, and let her go on tending bar. Of course, she never had a reckoning in Arizona. Jocelyn vanished with everyone else that Christmas day.
They walked to the entrance of town, where the buildings ended. Off in the distance, set up on a slope in the spruce, stood a church. Its roof had caved in everywhere except in front, where the tiny bell tower dangled in the rafters. Atop the tower, a crooked cross stood silhouetted against the darkening sky. June stopped.
"Honey," Emmett said, "what is it?"
"Nothing, just very similar energy to Roanoke Island."
"What's that?" Abigail asked.
"The Lost Colony. That settlement that vanished from the North Carolina coast in the late 1500s, where the only thing left behind was C-R-O carved into a tree. People thought C-R-O meant Croatan Indians, that maybe there'd been an attack. We did some work out there a few years ago. Energy's even stronger here."
"What kind of energy?" Abigail asked.
June turned toward her, and those eyes that had seemed so kind just the day before at their first meeting in Durango had taken on a disturbing intensity.
Something awful happened in this place.
Abigail couldn't stop the smile from escaping.
What?
June asked.
I'm sorry, she chuckled.
Oh, we have a skeptic.
Afraid so. Look, it's nothing against...
Emmett said. No, least you're up front about it. I respect that. Most people just patronize us and pretend to play along. But since you are writing an article about what we do, I hope you'll keep an open mind.
You have my word.
They camped on the edge of town. Abigail climbed into her tent and fell asleep, and when she woke, it was evening and cold. She found a pair of gloves in the top compartment of her pack and crawled outside. Low, dark clouds scudded across the peaks. She saw Scott lying in the grass with the llamas, listening to a radio. Lawrence was sitting in the open doorway of his tent, thumbing through a tattered notebook by the light of his headlamp. As Jared fed a piece of clapboard into the flames, she sat down across from him in the grass.
Jared?
She said. He glanced up.
You think it's a load of shit?
What? She cocked her head toward Emmett and June, who were a little ways off, on their knees facing the ghost town, heads bowed in meditative poses.
I don't know. They aren't quite as kooky as I imagined they'd be.
Abigail pulled off her gloves and extended her hands toward the flames. In the distance, the outline of abandon formed an eerie profile in the dusk. Scott walked over, followed by Lawrence and the Tozers.
What's up? Jared asked.
I was just listening to the latest report on my weather radio. Doesn't look good.
You're kidding, Lawrence said.
This early season storm was supposed to plow through New Mexico, and now the track is farther north. Not particularly cold, but it should be all snow above 9,000 feet. As you know, abandon sits at 11.
How much are they predicting?
Lawrence asked.
1 to 3 feet. Winter storm warnings are already up, supposed to start late tonight.
So what does this mean? June asked.
Means we should pack up our shit and make a beeline for the trailhead.
Jared looked up. You aren't serious.
Actually, I am.
Hike back in the dark?
Maybe we get only halfway. Be better than post-holing all 17 miles in a meter of powder.
You don't know that it's going to be that bad.
Don't know that it isn't.
Jared looked at Emmett.
You paid a hefty chunk to come out here and shoot this town. Have Lawrence give you the rundown.
What do you think you're doing? Scott asked.
I'm talking to our client. Maybe he should make the...
My client.
Don't know if you forgot, but you work for me, bro.
Emmett said,
We have to leave?
If this storm really winds up, Scott said, hiking out will be a bitch. We didn't bring snowshoes or skis. You ever tried to walk in 3 feet of snow?
Let them decide, Scott, Jared said.
Scott shot him a glare, then turned back to the Tozers.
Look, I suggest we get the hell out of here, but if you want to stay, see what happens, I guess that's an option.
What do you think, Lawrence?
Their dime, their permit, their choice.
Emmett glanced at his wife, then back at Scott.
This is our last chance to shoot abandon this year?
Yeah, it's late in the season, and a miracle there's not more snow already. We don't do it now, you won't be able to get back here until next June, or even July, depending on how bad the winter is. And that's assuming you get another permit.
Emmett said.
Honey?
In the silence, Abigail watched the dark, billowy clouds spilling over the top of the canyon, sweeping down into the ghost town like an avalanche. June looked at her husband, nodded.
We'll take our chances, he said, as abandon vanished in the fog.
1893. 7. Bartholomew Packer pushed open the door and stepped out of the storm. He brushed the snow from his wool overcoat, hung his derby on the coat rack. The floorboards creaked under the substantial load as he waddled toward the potbelly stove. While his fingers thawed, he surveyed Abandon's only remaining saloon. The light was poor. It disseminated in a smoky dimness from 3 kerosene lamps suspended from the ceiling, never reaching the corners of what was little more than a thin-walled shack. There were only 4 of them in the saloon tonight. He saw Lana Hartman across the room, seated at the upright piano by the front window, playing O Little Town of Bethlehem.
She was always here, as much a part of the place as the bar stools. He'd never seen her in this dress, dark green with red piping on the collar and cuffs. Jocelyn Maddox sat on a stool behind the bar, watching Lana play, a cigarette burning in her hand, eyes glazed with boredom. The young deputy tasked with guarding her had passed out in a chair beside the stove. A raging high lonesome, he snored, a line of tobacco-colored drool creeping down his chin. Bart stepped to the bar, said,
"Evening, Joss. Lively tonight."
"Merry Christmas, you big fucking walrus. Come to wet your dry?" She smiled and hopped off the chair, dressed tonight as always like a man. High-backed canvas trousers and a cotton dress shirt with suspenders. The disparity between her masculine outfits and the pitch-black hair that fell in waves down her back and the dark liquid pools of her big eyes drove men mad. She looked Spanish, exotic. The chain between her leg irons dragged across the floor as she set up a glass and uncorked a bottle of whiskey, poured Bart a full tumbler.
"I'm afraid you're drinking with me tonight," he said.
"That's so.
Reckon Miss Hartman would hoist a glass with our ilk?"
"I never seen her take a drink," Joss said. "And as you well know, many a man, present company included, have sent a whiskey over to that piano."
"How about our man by the stove?"
Joss's dark eyes cut to the sleeping deputy, then back to Bart. "Let that coffee cooler alone," she whispered. "And keep it down. He sees me drinking, I'll hear about it all fucking night." She got a glass for herself, and when she'd filled it, Bart raised his, said,
"Joss, here's how. May the coming year..."
"Now for Christ's sakes." She swallowed her whiskey, one long, deliberate tilting of the glass. Bart drained his. She poured again.
"Joss, love, wish you could have seen Abandon when it was a roaring camp. In 89, night like this, there'd have been 50 men here, miners coming off shift, card games, whole flock of whores."
"It's all over now, huh?"
"Yeah, all over, all gone. The whores, the opium, the fun."
He clinked his glass against hers and they drank. He replenished their tumblers and they drank and he refilled them again. Soon his face had flushed and gone blotchy and the burst capillaries stood out like tiny red worms, so that his nose resembled a rotting strawberry. Lines of sweat rolled down the dome of his great bald head. Bart was not a man to stand when there were chairs on the premises. He installed himself on a bar stool, and he and Joss worked their way through the bottle while Lana played Christmas carols and the deputy snored. He said things he'd already said 10 times before on nights just as quiet. About the town in its heyday, the art of following a rich vein deep into a mountain, and how he meant to close the mill next year and make a new fortune in Montana.
"Hey, how about shutting the fuck up for a spell? You're making my head hurt."
Bart attended to his whiskey. Looking through the window behind the bar, he could see it snowing harder than before. The walls strained against the wind. After a while, he got up, staggered over to the piano. He stood beside Lana, watching the spill of her blonde hair, her tiny gloved fingers moving across the keys. The piano had been out of tune ever since a miner had shot it 2 years ago in a fight, mistaking it for an adversary. When she'd finished the song, he said,
"That was very pleasant, Miss Hartman,"
and reached into his pocket. He withdrew a burlap sack that fit in his palm and placed it on the piano. Lana picked up the sack, her hand dipping with the weight. She untied the string and peeked inside, saw the dull gleam of dust and tiny slugs, probably $200 worth. She looked up at Bart and shook her head.
"Oh, no. It has been my greatest joy this year to watch you play. You're too good for this deadfall."
He started to lay his hand on her shoulder, but then stopped himself. He'd never touched her. Instead, he allowed himself a long drink of what he thought was far and away the softest face ever to grace the streets of Abandon. Bart returned to his seat at the bar.
"One more for the cold road home," he said.
And Joss poured the last of the bottle into his tumbler. Lana had begun to play again. When he finished his whiskey, Bart dropped another poke on the bar.
"And a Merry Christmas to you, Joss," he said.
She weighed the sack in her hand as if it might not serve, then smiled and leaned across the bar.
"You love her, don't you?" she whispered.
"Excuse me?
You're a seldom fucking hombre," Come in here every goddamn night, skip your own Christmas shindig just to listen to her bang.
Well, that don't mean...
Calm the fuck down, Bartholomew, and listen. You never know when it's your time. Mine's coming in the spring, and I guess this is just the long way around the barn of saying I hope you won't leave this world with any regret.
I don't understand what you...
Before you hive off, do what you've been meaning to ever since you laid eyes on that filly.
What in the hell are you...
I want you to kiss her.
I couldn't.
What's the worst she'll do? Slap you? I'm sure you've been slapped plenty. Hell, you ever tried something like that on me, I'd fucking shoot you. But that's neither here nor there. I reckon you love her, and this is my Christmas gift to you. Kiss her on your way out.
Bart stepped down off the stool and walked toward the door. He put on his overcoat and his hat and reached for the doorknob. He stopped. He walked back to the piano. His weak heart pounding, he leaned down and kissed Lana on the cheek. She stopped playing and bowed her head. They both trembled.
I apologize, Bart said. It's just that...
He hurried outside and shut the door. Lana took a deep breath, then looked out the window up to the second floor of the hotel across the street at the woman sitting in the bay window. You could hear the noise from the dance hall down the street, where most of the town had gathered for Christmas Eve. She started Silent Night on the discordant keys. Joss took a candle out from under the bar, went over to the stove, opened it, and held the wick to a flame. She set the burning candle in the windowsill behind the bar, stood there watching torrents of snow fall through the darkness, wondering if they could see her signal in the blizzard. 8. Stephen Cole buttoned his black frock coat and stepped onto the musician's platform, tall, pale, thin to the brink of fragility. His brown hair parted down the middle fell in greasy strings to his shoulders, and the only facial hair he could grow was a lean mustache more befitting a teenager than a 27-year-old man. It wasn't the snipe-gutted appearance people noticed, however, but his large eyes, brown, gentle, occasionally radiant.
Let us pray, he said.
Dear Lord, Redeemer, Maker of all that is good, we thank you for the bounty of that which we are about to eat, for the hands that prepared it, for the generous Mr. Packer, who allowed his boarding house cooks to make this feast for the town. We thank you for your perfect and loving Son, Jesus Christ, who you sent to save this despicable world. Let us remember the child born in a manger as we celebrate his birth this night and on the morrow. Finally, dear Lord, I ask that you pour out your protection upon Abandon. Protect us from the cold and snow, the deadly slides, the beasts of the mountains, the heathens, and, above all, from the wickedness in our own hearts. Kyrie Eleison. Amen.
As Stephen stepped down from the stage, the fiddlers took up their instruments and plucked at the strings, turning the tiny hardwood pegs. 2 years ago, this hurdy-gurdy would have been lined with whores of every make and model in threadbare peignoirs, bright stockings, some only children, others topless, a handful naked entirely, all painted up like lewd clowns, and the miners staggering drunk through the horde of dancers, the room redolent of a foul ambrosia, whiskey, sweat, and tobacco smoke commingling. But the mine had pinched out. The revelers departed, though their nights in the dance hall stood memorialized in the bullet-holed walls, stains of vomit, tobacco juice, and blood on the floorboards. This night, half a dozen tables had been arranged in the center of the room, decorated with ribbon, spruce saplings cut from the hillsides above town, and a whole multitude of candles. Ezekiel and Gloria Curtis sat at the end of the table nearest the sheet-iron stove, a silence descending as the residents of Abandon filled their plates from the pans of cornbread, vegetables, fried potatoes, sop, and whole roasts. The hanging lamps did little to illumine the hall, the faces an indistinct canvas for shadow and candlelight. Gloria sat across from Harriet McCabe, watching the little girl devour her supper, dripping sauce on her white pinafore.
"Are you ready for Santa Claus?" Gloria said. "I hear he's on his way to Abandon this hour."
Harriet glanced at her mother, as if to confirm the validity of the claim. Tears slid down Bessie McCabe's face.
"Bessie?" Gloria whispered. "What is it?" Are you poorly?
Barely 20, Bessie's pink cotton work dress was her best, stained and torn across the front from countless trips to the woodpile, hardly warm enough for a Rocky Mountain winter. Bessie had come from Tennessee 10 months ago to join her husband. Found him quite changed from the 15-year-old boy she'd married. She carried the dull burn of poverty in her eyes, and the stress of living this high in the dead of winter, with a man losing his mind, was causing her straw-colored hair to fall out in clumps.
"It's Billy," Bessie whispered, covering her mouth with her hand to mask rotten teeth.
Gloria reached across the table and held Bessie's hand.
"Where is he?"
"Where you reckon?" Bessie's voice broke on the last word.
"With Mr. Wallace?"
"Sometimes. I suspect they go to the cribs."
"Mr. McCabe loves you," Gloria said, then felt a pinch under the table.
She turned and met her husband's disapproving eyes.
"So, Mrs. McCabe," Ezekiel said, "how's Mr. McCabe finding his job at the mine?"
"Still just a mucker. But him and Mr. Wallace been dirt washing on Billy's day off, looking for someone to grubstake him."
"Well, here's hoping he sees some color in his pan."
He raised his glass of water, and when he'd taken a sip, turned his attention to the little girl. As he quizzed Harriet on her studies, Gloria nibbled on a piece of cornbread and stole glances at her husband. She was still wildly in love with him. This solid, gorgeous man with a thick mustache, long sideburns, and the most ardent eyes she'd ever seen, especially when in a state of passion, anger, or otherwise. As if there were lava at his core. She'd convinced him to wear his 4-button sack coat for the occasion, an outfit he despised and which, in his words, made him look like
a feathered-out goddamn banker.
At length, Gloria's attention drifted away from their table, and she picked out pieces of other conversations about towns that were booming, towns that were busting. As she eavesdropped, she noticed the table closest to the musician's platform. 10 people occupied one side, but at the far end a woman ate by herself, completely ignored. She estimated the woman to be in her mid-40s, and even from across the room, Gloria could tell that she'd been striking years ago. Now she just looked tired, ragged out in a burgundy bustle ball dress, with white lace at the ends of the sleeves, and intricate beading of a style fashionable in the 70s.
"Would you excuse me?"
Before Ezekiel could reply, she was on her way, stopping finally across the table from the woman in the outdated dress.
"May I sit here, Rosalind?"
Gloria asked. The woman smirked, her hair pinned up in a mass of garnet curls, her cheeks rouged.
"If you don't care what all these hypocrites think, I sure don't."
As Gloria set her food on the table and pulled out the chair, she couldn't help but note the thrill of hearing a woman speak her true mind again. In proximity, Gloria saw that the woman was even more striking, but even more ruined. It broke her heart. She thought of her mother, what she might have become had the syphilis not claimed her.
"How are you liking the..."
"I don't do pity too well. What possessed you to come over here?"
"I seen you around."
"So have half the men in this room, and they feign outrage that I dare partake of this feast in their presence, laughing up their sleeves. You know, I used to be loved in this town, like royalty."
"Look, I just saw you were alone."
"Well, you done your good deed, so why don't you head back over?"
Rosalind stopped herself, reached out, touched the long, blanched scar under Gloria's bottom lip.
"Where'd you work, honey?"
Gloria flushed, took a sip of water.
"I don't. Anymore."
"I said when you did."
"Leadville."
Rosalind smiled.
"Hell of a place. You're stunning. Bet the men loved you. What happened to your chin?"
"I had a customer who went insane. Thought we were married and that I was cheating on him."
Rosalind laughed out loud, heads turned.
"This town's in high water," Gloria said. "Don't mind my asking, why have you stayed? Thought you might have gone to Cripple Creek."
Rosalind smiled, wisdom and a lifetime of buried rage in her eyes.
"Been a whore all my life. I'll finish out in abandon, and when it goes, take what money I got, go somewhere where nobody knows me, where it don't snow, buy a house, tend a garden.
Marriage?
I'm afraid man's a species that's been ruined for me. Gloria sliced through a piece of roast.
How'd you become so respectable?
Rosalind asked.
Fell in love with a good man.
Not many of those left, are there? Now they Blackhawk waltzed, the fiddlers sawing away, the clack of high-top lace-ups and stovepipe boots slamming the floorboards. Looking over her husband's shoulder, Gloria saw Rosalind sitting by herself in a rocking chair beside the stove.
It's shameful, she said to him.
You know who that woman is?
Ezekiel spoke into his wife's ear. Wipe that feature off your face. She's a human being.
Would you have people unriddle your past?
Would you have people treat me like I didn't exist?
They bumped into the Ilgs. Excuse us, Sawbones. Merry Christmas, Sheriff. Look at you in your full war paint. Ma'am?
The doctor doffed his bowler.
When they'd broken from the crowd, Ezekiel said, That woman ain't my concern.
Is decent human behavior? You're gonna dance with her.
Damn if I will.
Zeke!
He glanced over her shoulder, whispered, God bless that man. Gloria turned, saw Rosalind rise to accept the hand of Stephen Cole. Soon the preacher and the whore were stomping together.
9. Ezekiel and Gloria walked down the plank sidewalk. It had been shoveled that morning, but a foot and a half of powder had fallen since then. Gloria tucked her gloved hands under the wool of her hooded cape. Aside from the ruckus of the dance hall, abandoned stood in that kind of mad silence that set in during the worst of blizzards. There appeared to be no one else out, and the snow fell so hard they could see only the nearest street lamp. Beyond lay only faint suggestions of lantern light. They arrived at the entrance to the hotel, the door starred with snowballs, the handiwork of bored children. Across the street there was light in the saloon, and they could hear the sound of Christmas carols being played on the broken piano. They entered the dark lobby. There hadn't been anyone at the front desk since the owner had left town 3 months ago. Gloria brushed the snow off her cape and followed Ezekiel up the staircase. The corridor was empty, completely dark. They stopped at number 6, the only room with light sliding under the door. Ezekiel knocked. They waited. He knocked again.
I don't reckon she's going to answer, Gloria whispered.
Mrs. Madsen? Ezekiel said through the door. It's Zeke and Glory Curtis. We're leaving something for you. Merry Christmas.
Gloria set the basket on the floor. It contained 2 oranges, a can of sardines, and a piece of chocolate cake from the town feast. On a scrap of parchment, Gloria had written, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from your friend, the Curtises. They went back outside and trudged on through the snow.
Saw Otha Wallace today, Ezekiel said. He was in the benzinery this morning. Told him my brother's over 2 months short now.
What'd he say?
What he says every time. That Nathan and the others decided not to go last minute, since the weather looked ominous. I called him a black liar.
What do you think happened?
Don't know, Glory. It's past me. But that man's bad medicine. Snaky.
What if it turns out Nathan was with him?
This is the end of disc number 1. Please insert disc number 2.